And that's when it said, you're in the in-between. You're standing inside the eternity of a single moment.
You might have heard about a lot of NDEs and, you know, the near-death experience encounter. Each and every one is unique. Now, we've talked with PMH Atwater, who's done studies and over, I think, 4,000 tons of interviews with near-death experiencers to find out what the commonalities are in terms of recovery and of unpacking the experience. And it takes a while, just like a spiritually transformative event, which an NDE is. Perfect for this kind of story is a guy who's been there, done that, NBC reporter, Nat Geo, Emmy Award winner. There's a whole laundry list I could go into, but I'm going to let you read the bio and go to his website, inbetweenproductions.com.
2016, I was out on the second test flight of one of my experimental aircraft, a vintage reproduction, and I lost my engine and crashed into all of these trees at 70 miles an hour, pretty much just rendering the entire aircraft into a bunch of matchsticks. Broke my ribs, ruptured my lungs. You know, I was just really badly beat up. And they called in a helicopter to save me, and they flew me up to Hartford's Trauma Center, where in very short order, they realized the best thing to do is to put me into a coma for about a week while they conducted day-long operations on me. In contrast to a lot of near-death experiences, where we might travel through a tunnel to a beautiful realm, see heavenly beings, have a life review, and things like that, I didn't get any of those.
Jim Brunton. How do I pronounce it, Jim?
Brunton.
Aha!
I've been called worse. It's all right.
Okay, good. Jim Brunton. Okay. Yeah, I could have done my research and found that out, but I prefer just to, you know, stumble through it and be real. So the book is called, and this is great, The In-Between, A Trip of a Lifetime. So kind of in the near death, you're in the lifetime, you're still all running and current. This is completely, it looks like a sci-fi landscape. I saw the presentation with the Charlotte Ions group trying to tell people what this was like. I think the visuals are incredibly helpful. Now, the thing is, you had an extraordinary background being a reporter. You traveled all over. You were in the Middle East as a war correspondent, and you did wilderness guide in Africa. You had an incredibly vivid and exotic, exciting lifestyle. So you weren't a stranger to being, I think, in a tough spot. This, and you're flying an experimental, it looked like it was a tri-wing. It was a unique aircraft, and you're flying this had to be like the most joyful event you could have happening. This, you're like at, I, and you know, the way I would describe it is you'd achieved everything you wanted to achieve, and then you're stepping out and all of a sudden this is a new reality. How did that fit? How did that work? You're thinking, is it over? What happened next?
That's a great way to sum it up, Wendy. You know, I'd certainly been able to check off a lot of things on my list of childhood dreams, you know, the interest in wildlife and wildlife filming and adventure travel all around the world. And, you know, even from the science fiction perspective, inventing some satellite technology we were able to use transmit video.
Yes, wait, go there, because that's where all us media people are going, wow, okay, because of you, some of us are able to do our jobs better. Yeah.
Glad to help. Yeah, when I was in Namibia, which is in southwestern Africa, filming a sunset one time on top of a tall sand dune, I was literally 300 miles from anyone. And a ranger came up, driving up the dune with a caravan of four-wheel drive vehicles in tow. And I found it was a Disney film crew scouting a location. And they had an early model of a satellite telephone. It looked really cool. It was a bunch of cases and a metalized but flexible satellite dish, and then their telephone handset. And they were able to talk back in real time to their studios in LA and just basically report in their day's progress. And I'm standing there looking at that thinking, I wonder if anyone's ever sent video over that. So I asked them, they didn't know, and I swore that I was going to figure it out. And I did. And I was the only person in a long time who could. It was like taking a TV truck and putting it in a backpack. So that allowed global news at large, if you will,
yeah,
to now be able to transmit from places formerly impossible live video. So I set about showing everybody how to do that. I produced the Titanic expedition for Discovery Channel, winning them Yahoo Site of the Year, both polar regions. I've been to Antarctica 6 times. I went to the North Pole once. And then we went to Mount Everest several times, twice. I was a lecturer at Yale University School of Medicine, integrating some formerly classified biometrics that were becoming declassified and on the way to the space station, pills that take your temperature and transmit it wirelessly 3 feet, all kinds of really cool science fiction type gadgets.
Wow.
So we went to Everest 2 years in a row to test those. And then as the dot-com bubble burst, the only people left with any money to pay me to run around the world and use my system were the major news organizations. So I worked for every one of them. Mm-hmm. And it was shortly after I started just before 9/11, and right after 9/11, I was off for, months, in the Middle East and then in Southeast Asia, Northern Africa, and all that. And then I was embedded with the Marines in Iraq during all of 2003. That's a quick update on the technology front.
And that's intense. Well, see, what I pictured of you as I was reading was Al Franken with the hat. I'm like, okay, here he is.
Yeah, just like that. A lot of people would make that joke, like the one man satellite band or something, just
not knowing it could be real.
Yeah, exactly. You could almost say maybe Al Franken was my inspiration.
Yeah. Well, okay. So with this, though, it gives people an idea that you're no stranger to exotic experiences. So when you have a near-death experience and it's completely off the charts, and I just want to say that PMH Atwater is so, she's like, exclamation park, you got to read it. This is, you're getting accolades because of how unusual and extraordinary your experience is. It connects a lot of dots for people in a very in an abstract way. So if you could describe, there's the crash, you're in a coma. How quickly are you aware that you are no longer in the physical?
It's kind of hard to say exactly, only because as you with the physical shock of the crash, with the anesthesia, with whatever they give you to put you into a coma, plus painkillers, it's kind of hard to say really where here ended and there began. But what I can say is this, between the two bookends of the experience, if you will, that I would say were marked by basically amnesia and like the painkillers and shock, was this incredibly lucid moment that I had in this place I learned was called the in-between. And in contrast to a lot of near-death experiences where we might travel through a tunnel to a beautiful realm, see heavenly beings, have a life review and things like that, I didn't get any of those goodies. I really went to this purgatorial looking place. It looked like a large city like New York, maybe hundreds or thousands of years after the meteor strike or the nuclear blast or something. It's just a totally dead and ruined city. But I wasn't afraid. I was just looking at it and taking it in. And I remember these huge, dark storm clouds over me, like they were just getting ready to unload tons of rain and lightning and all that. And somewhere in here, I suddenly got hit by a wave of nausea. And I remember sort of doubling over thinking, I don't think I can stand this anymore. And when I sort of said that out loud to myself, all of a sudden I heard and saw this slight motion to my left. There was a large, basically a four-story shape of an egg made out of lattice work, meaning big open areas you could see through.
My guest is Jim Bruton, and the In Between, the name of the book, The In Between, A Trip of a Lifetime, Near-Death Experience. Okay, so this is where you're looking at this giant four-story tall egg and trying to figure out with the relevance, and it's in a desolate landscape. New York is trashed. Okay, that's not really cheery, but we'll save that for later.
That's right. Yeah, this wasn't going to be where we were going to have fun.
Yeah.
So I looked at the egg and I could just sense that there was this connection between it and me. So I made my way over to it and I looked through that open lattice work, and within I could see these special gears that are called sector gears, a sector meaning a section of a fully round gear, like a wheel with the little teeth.
Yeah.
But these kind of gears you find in clocks. And generally they're built to sweep back and forth, meaning there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to their movement. That makes a certain logical sense when I describe them in more detail. As I looked at the different sector gears, they were sort of like freely suspended in space, each arcing differently than others. Sometimes even like ghosts passing through each other. Everything about this looked normal, looked real, but would have been physically impossible. And I put my hand through the lattice work to just sort of see, gosh, can I touch these things? Is there any sensation here? Mm-hmm. And one brushed by my hand, causing me immense pain in the form of nausea in my stomach. And I just reflexively grabbed it, pulled it out through the lattice work, and threw it away. And all of a sudden, all the other deer start spinning around. And at that point, I said, like, what is this thing? And a disembodied voice that stayed with me the rest of the experience said, this is the process of becoming. This is the future birthing into the now. And as I saw the all the gears that remained recalibrating, I said, you know, what's happening here? And it said, your future is having to reset itself to an event that's not meant to be. And I said, how did I know I could do that, remove that bad gear? And it said, why else are you here? I said, I have no idea. I don't even know what this place is. And that's when it said, you're in the in-between. You're standing inside the eternity of a single moment. And I just looked, I'm sure I looked confused. And it said, do you remember the world to which your body belongs? And I said, no, because I didn't. It's mm-hmm. like I've said, if somebody walked up to me and said, gosh, you know, if you stay here any longer, you can't go back. I'd say, go back where? To your family. And what family? Yeah. I had no memory. I was really depersonalized down to zero. Mm-hmm. And that's when it said, now you see the truth and how the past is dust. So I came to understand that this whole exercise, if you will, this whole experience was tailored around me being able to reach inside this egg. And even though these gears were in various degrees of what I'd call focus, mm-hmm. each time I looked at one, I could see what it represented. It's like a video feed played in my head. And I realized these are events in my future, thoughts, words, and deeds. And I was being given the opportunity to use my sense of feel and certainly my sense of pain to discover the ones in my future that would be to my spiritual detriment and get rid of them. Kind of like stacking the deck,
yes.
if you will.
Yes. Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So by removing these, say, bad choices in my future, then they would be beyond temptation and consideration. And therefore, I was leaving, in terms of the choices I was leaving, proportionally, they were increasingly good choices, or at least neutral, but nothing that, you know, we could say would be bad.
Right.
So I just kept fishing around and, you know, every now and then one would hurt. I'd grab it and throw it away and just kind of kept doing that over and over and over while 1 week ticked by here and perhaps a split second over there passed by. And eventually I turned around and saw a huge pile of gears and I said, wow, if I don't have a bad future, I have no future at all. And it said to me, the in-between said to me, your number of breaths are already counted. I will worry about your last one. And I said, what am I missing here, you know, in my lack of understanding? It said, what is clearly before you? Grace. No one deserves salvation. It can only be given by grace. But it has to be chosen at the expense of the world that separates us. And then it said, and then I said something about, you know, I feel kind of ashamed that I'm not using more of a moral compass than pain to determine, you know, the bad things in my future to remove.
Uh-huh.
And it said, if those who have choices make poor use of them, then offering fewer possibilities could be called mercy.
Yeah.
That's kind of humbling and it's profound and yet it's still somewhat gentle. And in the end, it said, you know, pay more attention to your relationships and everything is interconnected and be gentle with everyone as I am gentle with you. And I said, gosh, what's gentle about all this? And it said, your being here is an answer to a prayer. And now the man who fell from the sky is not the same who flew into it. And with that, it pretty much booted me back.
I love that. And that was one of the things I just blogged. Okay. And what I blogged was that, why I'm delaying a certain amount of input on the blog site that I use. Let me share that because I'm just floored with the language you just used and had to step back and let go of some of my daily routine. Mom is unwell, waiting for a diagnosis, tap dancing, assisting without knowing or anticipating, allowing discovery to reveal a path and a lesson, whatever's needed for the journey. I love her, but I'm not privy to her code. I hope the remedy is to drink more water, fingers crossed. Now, Engaged and alert, intent on seating balance and alignment, I have no desire to recast the old normal. My focus is on assimilation of all that might have been overlooked and cast aside on the drive to retain a regularity that in all likelihood contributed to an imbalance. Course redirect. Let's tweak that. So as I reconsider, recollect, and connect to all that which inspires and consequently motivates me to entertain and juggle ever more oddities, quirks, and unknowns, as I embrace that which defies conventional mold, I look to that which challenges me to remember. Miracles are yet to be revealed. Imagination and wonder are get-out-of-jail-free cards. We each have the ability to stack the deck in our favor. I'm looking for the best card I can find for Mom. And here we are, surfing.
That's amazing.
So that's what I'm writing before I'm getting ready to interview you, thinking, I've got to catch up. And then you're saying, we stack the deck. Heck yes, we stack the deck.
Absolutely. We are given that opportunity every moment by our choices. It's all about choices. The past is dust. The future is an infinite set of probabilities birthing into the now. And we're going to choose amongst those millions of probability waves in that quantum moment, which one to collapse into a single particle of reality. That's what we're doing. That's called choice.
I love the language, the atmosphere, the way that this is laid out. And your publicist said, hey, he really wants to talk about the next step, the new book. So we're getting through this first book now, because this is, we have to start on this plane of how you got to where you are. But I am so sure that your next plane is even more revealing. You've got a tremendous amount of philosophy, a tremendous amount of nuts and bolts of how things connect and what we are doing in the moment to work our own connections without knowing. And you are a perfect example of someone who has been given knowledge that actually has code without being explained or out being defined, but it is still relevant and all part of your package. How do you feel when you're trying to explain to people stuff that is so abstract?
You know, it's interesting. What you said right now is actually a big topic that I'm writing about, and it's very much going to be in my second book. That what I heard you say was that some of these truths seem slightly ambiguous. And I was thinking, yeah, kind of like a fortune cookies, right?
Yes, yes.
Right, it's like fortune cookie truth. But I've realized that if you read some of the like Eastern books, like the Tao Te Ching, you know, mm-hmm. the book of Taoism, some of its best truths are highly ambiguous. And I think one of the reasons that some of the best truths are that way is because it forces us to stretch to them. And then stretching toward that truth, we're working in overdrive to sort of fill the gaps with our own life experience, or maybe live according to that truth to see how experience unfolds and fills those gaps. In so doing, we start to own that truth. And one day we will repeat that truth, but now in our own language, our own vernacular, with our own inflection, our own body language, all those things that grant us an authority to speak that truth that others cannot imitate. And that is the difference between light and dark.
My guest is Jim Bruton. This is what I wrote, and this is a blog that introduces the post I shared earlier. How many nights now has the stream told you? This is the way to deal with obstacles. And that's Dale Pendel, the interview here with him, the poet of plants. And I thought, okay, this is how I'm going to do this. And now all of a sudden I'm talking with you, Jim, and everything that you're doing kind of reflects this thing that I was writing about. So I'm really glad to hear your story, because this, I think, is the kind of content that inspires people to be creative, to think outside the box, and know that no matter what happens in between, we are still part of the story that is creating the result. Does that make sense?
Everything you're saying today, Wendy, is spot on, and I can easily speak to it. I think it's interesting because one of the things you're alluding to there is the individuality of all our experiences, whether they're near-death experiences or whether more generally defined spiritually transformative experiences. I mean, truly the target is one and the archers are many. And it's amazing how many people recounting their experience will say, gosh, it's like it was tailor-made. I mean, it's as if the experience knew me to my core. It knew all my secrets, my hopes, my dreams. I mean, it was just that intimate and that humbling. And I really do feel that here on this plane of creation, we see life through the filters we want. When we look in the mirror in the morning, we see the best looking person or the most confident person, things like that. And we look for signs of validation. Yeah. There's no sweeter sound than the sound of our own name. However, on the other side, we see life through the filters we need. When we look in the mirror there, it's a mirror of truth. And we see ourselves, warts and all. And there's no hiding behind an ego barrier, if you will. We get it straight, just like that. And so that's why it can be humbling. But that's what we obviously need at that moment in our spiritual evolution. And that further speaks to, like, near-death experiences. I've wondered, if we look at it from the outside, we might say, wow, that seemed like a random and somewhat quantum event. But I think if we better knew each other's stories, we would see that a near-death experience, while looking sudden and unexpected, may well be, I hate to almost say it, but like a synchronicity, that yeah. It was something that was the next natural step in our evolution. And obviously it's a shock to the system. We could say birth is, but it was critical and it was perfectly timed, because I have no regrets about my crash. To me, because of the near-death experience, it was totally worth it. And what's interesting is a lot of people who have a near-death experience due to some trauma, whether it's, you know, an illness or an accident or, you know, falling out of the sky, terrible thing that delivers us to the near-death experience becomes a footnote in the story. Almost, that's right, I did, you know, have this horrific crash. But without the near-death experience, any one of those terrible events would be the story. And I find that to be an interesting differentiator.
And when I'm looking at your stuff, this wasn't a tragedy. At this point, you were, as you're right, his passion, building and flying World War I era aircraft. And that's what you were doing. You were, to me, it was like, this was, it was a wonderful accelerated moment of passion and joy and enthusiasm and wow, here I am. And then oops, well, that was quick, as the card flipped, you know. It's like, okay, yeah, then you were on the, now you're back to the Fool card. All right, you were doing the Tower of the Death and all that, and now the Fool and the Hermit, and from there to go forward, I'm using the tarot as that thing, the Sun, which is like the creator, be all end all, one. And here you are coming back saying, you've already been down that other route of doing the things that you checked off your bucket list, the things that you checked off as somebody who's successful and who is an innovator, and all those things are there. So I want to know, what's next?
Well, it's interesting. As I've had the opportunity to, and very gratefully so, to share my experience with others, and you know, we're all comparing notes in our journey home as we walk sometimes side by side with our new redefined sense of friends and family, I find people have asked me, so how do we, you know, things you say, things you're sharing are resonating with us. How do we put this into practice? So I started on my second book, and it's actually going to be a topic for an upcoming near-death experiencer summit with Tricia Barker on August 1st and 2nd. And my topic will be to segue from this book to the second book. And the second book is going to be titled The Practice in Between, The Art of Letting Go. Uh-huh. And it's all predicated. Yeah, okay, you
yes.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I should have. Yes. Okay.
And it's all, first of all, I can certainly say it's predicated upon my experience and what I've been able to distill from my experience. Let me give you an example. When I was recuperating in my rehabilitation hospital, and the layers of the in-between was descending upon me in greater detail and honestly more force, even just emotional force. It was pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. I, for a moment, had a conversation with it or with God, and he removed from me the representation of alcohol and cigars. And I've been a vegetarian for, you know, like 40 something years, so generally healthy living. But I had a stressful job before the crash, and I might come home at the end of the day and, you know, have a rum and coke or two or maybe three. And you know,
okay, yeah, all right.
Exactly, you know, just sort of check out for a little while.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I was an alcoholic, but I'll get to that in a second. And you know, on my drive home, I might have a cigar just to relax and, you know, sort of solve all the problems of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I'm laying in bed, this representation of alcohol and cigars they come out of me and they're sort of hovering in space in front of me. And you know, the voice of the great mystery said, "What do you want to do with these? Do you want to take them with you, meaning into your future, or do you want to leave them behind? If you want to take them with you, I will carry them for you. If you want to leave them behind, I will remove all your attachment to them. It'll be as if you never had them, and they'll have no pull on you." Well, it didn't take long of thinking about that, and I said, "Let's leave them behind." And I said, "All right." And with that, those representations essentially disappeared from view. I haven't had another drink since. Don't even think about it. It's not like it's a battle. It left my mind, and like I said, it's as if I never did it and never had an association with it. I can go into a store and buy something for somebody, or I could sit at a bar and talk to somebody, but like being a vegetarian is where eating meat is something other people do.
Mm-hmm.
Drinking is that way as well. Now, the cigars. Okay, about 9 months after all this, I'm sitting at home, and I realized that one of my biggest challenges is extreme detachment. It's as if my roots have been ripped out and planted in another field. I have absolute detachment to everything and everyone around me. And my wife was getting concerned and said, you know, maybe we should go see a marriage therapist. You know, anything we could think of to try and
connect. Help. Yeah, connect.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's understandable. It's totally understandable. And this, of course, is one of the challenging after effects from a near-death experience.
Yeah.
So I was sitting here thinking, okay, I can actually sit here and just stare at a wall for 6 hours straight and it doesn't bother me. It's like no time passed. I said, I need to think of things I can do to help ground me.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, so I started every day going out for a drive in the morning and in the afternoon. It was just God, the in-between and me. And that was me having a cigar as well. And that is in honor to when he said, if you want to take this with you, I will carry it for you.
Uh-huh.
So the only time I ever have a cigar is when I'm driving and meditating and communing with God. I do not have it socially on the deck or the barbecue or anything like that. It's just with God and me. And this honors what he said. And this, I believe, keeps our agreement intact, if you will. So it's kind of a communal thing.
My guest is Jim Bruton, and we're talking about his near-death experience. Thanks for tuning in. I'll put some links on the website. You can check out his own site, the images we're talking about with this, because they're really, I think, fascinating. But the images that you share in the IN's Charlotte video there, it shows that egg, and it also shows it on your website. So if you want to go to his website, that's inbetweenproductions.com and check out the pictures. Also, there's one of you and the cigar. That's like in the top. There's... It's like, that's what I was curious about. Okay, so you've had the NDE. How did it go with all of the old vices? And did the old vices stick around? Because you're right. What happens is there's no longer that emotional cue, that tug, that pull, that addiction to certain things because they no longer have relevance. They don't tie you to anything. And you have to figure out, why am I here? What's important? What can I attach to? What can I connect with that makes me feel a way that is positive? And I can look at a drop of rain and go, whoa. Okay, that might not be exciting for somebody else, but yeah, you're right. You just, wow. The awe is better. The awe is so much more awesome. And that's what I hear in your story with this, is that you have devised a way to give yourself a cue to say, I'm here now. But instead of making that a vice, you've made it a virtue. Does that make sense?
It does, Wendy. You know, the way I thought of it is before my NDE, that was Gen 1.0. The NDE was a reboot, and now this is Gem 2.0.
Yeah. How relevant. Yes. With the first book, people are going to get an idea of just how traveled you were and all of the things that, that your life, you know, that laid out for you. Did you have a feeling when you were reconnecting of how and why you constructed that reality and any past life awareness, or what was that like?
In terms of why the in-between looked the way it did?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's so that I wouldn't be distracted. Let's face it, I was very much on a mission there, and I had limited amount of time, if you will, at least time as Earth measures it, to get the job done. I was being given this amazing opportunity to remove stones from my future path so that I could better expedite my evolution into being a better spiritual person. So I think if I had had beautiful scenes and angelic beings and beautiful music and all these other things going on, it'd been quite easy to be distracted. I mean, wouldn't you want to go talk to people like that, or talk to your long, you know, like yeah. your grandmother or grandfather who passed? However, I was given almost like a blank canvas upon which to paint. I mean, I was in this city that was absolutely dead, no reason to explore. The discomfort conveyed by these storm clouds that like they're ready to unload presents a certain urgency as well. So I was using it to my best advantage to get as much done as I could in the time I was there. And eventually it was me who said, I think I can live with this now. That I think was the cue to come back. So that's why I think it looked the way it did. And I honestly believe that place existed only for as long as it needed to for while I was there. Kind of like a boot camp. You know, you go and you get your fanny kicked until they tear you down to build you up in order to survive what's coming next. There are no feelings of unconditional love, but it is unconditional love that cares enough that you survive the battle that you can return from.
Well, the philosophy that you heard, I mean, that was just beautiful. That's what I think is a connector of, there's this, it's not a reprimand, but a, how do you want to proceed with this?
That's exactly it. You know, I think, I mean, I came back with this deep intuitive understanding that, like, if you said to God, I want to be a mafia boss. I like the clothes. I like the girls. I like the power. I like the money, the cars, you know, whatever. God would just pretty much say, well, go see how that works out for you. And then come back and I'm not going anywhere. Because, you know, once we're adults, we don't really need to be told what to do in terms of what's right and what's wrong. By then, we pretty much have it figured out. But sometimes we just want what we want for the reasons we want it. But I'll be honest. In this practice of letting go, I mean, I was letting go of these bad choices that may have been the fruit of past actions, or they may have been the fruit of certain unfulfilled desires. Who knows? And really, who cares? If you know they hurt, let them go. Don't be tempted by the fact it might be winning the Powerball, but now you've become the biggest jerk, making all kinds of promises that you won't. Better just to know that it can cause that pain and to let it go. It's all about reconnecting to God, to recognizing our birthright as spiritual enlightened beings, and to really get there as quickly as we can, because I think we are all in agreement that if the world didn't need us to be the best people we can be right now, then we've never had that need.
The book is The In-Between, A Trip of a Lifetime, Jim Bruton. And, you know, this part of it, I think, is so incredible that you have removed the things that would have been distracting to help you focus on this next part of the story, letting go. So you're practicing what you are sharing and giving a template for how it works. And what you're describing with the experience is, I will carry it for you. In other words, if you're having to choose to take the cigar because it binds you to the moment, it integrates it, it gives you a sensation of being present now, then you're using it as a method tool. You know, it's like a reminder, a cue, and it's actually, in some ways, a crutch.
Right.
Okay. But it's necessary.
Yeah. And I have no worry, concern, or shame about that. You know, we need to use everything that's at our fingertips to help us smooth the ball downfield. I mean, we really have to, this is a battle we have to win if we want to be, you know, thinking dual terms or thinking those kind of polarities. This is not a battle we can afford to lose. This is the only battle that really exists. In fact, using battle as a metaphor, there's an old saying that speaks perfectly to the art of letting go. And that's, on the field of battle, when a samurai draws his sword and throws his scabbard away, it's because he'll never need it again. On this day, he's now free to fight his death. And we should live every moment of our lives with that much surrender, that much abandon, and that much letting go. And when we can do that, we can, I think, sort of reharmonize to the natural order of things. And in doing that, I think we would see synchronicities become much more of a norm than an exception. Those little moments that tell us there's something more to life than the apparent.
It's hard to get around the fact that if I'm with somebody, I can touch them, I can smell them, I can sense them, I can feel them. But when I'm with somebody who's no longer here, those sensations are a little lighter. They might touch me on the shoulder, or I feel something brush across my forehead, or I'll feel a pain or a nudge inside, an internal cue saying, yes, I'm here. But I don't have the joy of giving somebody a hug. And that's where we are caught with the physical being so real that it's hard to detach without an assist. And you're ahead of the game on that one.
Well, I think another key point you've just brought up is, you know, I believe that souls incarnate here because this is the plane of intensity. This is where intense things happen. Now, I'm not going to say that, you know, joy on a higher plane isn't intense, but these are called the sublime planes, and there's a reason for that. Because here, in experiencing these intensities, it's kind of like, you know, why do we go to Disney World? We want something intense. We want to go on the big rides, or
yes,
go in the haunted house or things like that. We go to sports events because we want to feel pumped up by all that energy. It's the same thing. So when we're all carried away by this intensity, it's over a lifetime or several lifetimes, it's easy to start forgetting our more sublime spiritual natures. But this is the practice of meditation, that in opening that third eye, we're starting to see with that sublime eye the things that are too subtle to see here. With that eye, we can actually see the life in things.
Yes.
But that's a lot harder to do with a physical eye. So as our attachments start to fall away here, we start to maybe go through a feeling of emptiness for a while, and that can be a little disconcerting. But in that becoming empty, we're becoming open to being filled with that sublime, and then recognizing that it's there, and then starting to sort of recreate our personal address, if you will, in that space.
Jim Bruton, The In-Between, A Trip of a Lifetime, a near-death story, and we kind of covered this in a previous conversation, but when this happened to you, you're at the peak. I think you've done all sorts of things that you really wanted to do. You've excelled. You've got an Emmy. You've created a technology that we are using now, thanks to you, that improves our ability to transmit stories globally. And so you're part and parcel of all of this. And yet, at some point, you had a checklist. You had to go back to the source and say, okay, did that. Now what? And reminder, without telling you what you were going to do, that this was still on your plate. That's so cool. Maybe it wasn't to you.
Well, like I said, maybe it was just the next step in my personal evolution, having checked so many of the other things off the list, you know. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I mean, if any of us at any time during the day can say something or do something that lifts someone else up, even an inch, it's wonderful. I mean, the word educate doesn't mean I'm going to put knowledge in your head. It means to draw forth. And back in the day that the word was created, the teacher's role was to say to their students, all truth and all beauty already exist within you. My role as your educator is to draw forth from you what is already there, to remind you of what you already know. Imagine waking up in a world like that.
Yes.
How much respect is inherent in that viewpoint already from the get-go? That's how we can talk with each other. That's how we can treat each other. And when we really do wake up in that world and we talk to people in terms of their highest potential, our body language, our nuance, our inflection, our choice of words, the light in our eyes, everything says that for that moment, that person is talking to someone who believes in them, who is calling that highest out of themselves. And guess what? One day you're going to realize that maybe you're the only person in that person's life who ever did that. On that day, you may have made a real difference, and now they can make a difference.
Well, you see that with children who've been abused or who've been discounted or in some way demoralized, you know, shamed. And then some person comes into their life and says, you can do this. Why can't you do this? Everybody else does. You can too. You just haven't been given the opportunity. And those kinds of things, then you see people make tremendous life shifts. And it's because all of a sudden somebody says, you have permission, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what we should, that's what we should be doing every day for each other, whether someone appears to need it or not. We don't know what's going on in their inner world, but everybody can probably use a little bit of a lift every day. And we can do it without any effort. It costs us nothing, and we have nothing to lose.
Okay, so you were 1.0, the old gym, with the alcohol, the cigars, and the fast lifestyle, and the high, as in higher for the, it's an excitement, an adrenaline rush that you were pushing the envelope to see just how far you could go. Mount Everest, you know, how many times do you need to go there? because it was fun.
5 years in a row.
Yeah. Okay. See, poor thing. Okay. But there's that addiction to the adrenaline rush of doing something different, doing something unexpected and unplanned and uncharted. It's always new. It's always fresh. It's always exciting. And so to go from that to being able to sit 6 hours solid doing absolutely zero zilch, nothing, that is a huge 2.0. Where did that come from? How does that integrate? Because a lot of people, that's a mind blow to say that all of a sudden you don't need those extras and you're satisfied and content with standing still.
You asked a great question, and it's hard for me to actually speak to how that happens. All I can say is that it certainly makes for challenges with your relationships. You know, like my wife came in and pretty much said, gosh, you look like my spouse, but you know, who's this person? Because you're different in so many ways. And you know it down to your core because you react to things, even new things, differently than the old person. And honestly, when we were in marriage counseling one time, she was like, missing some of my, what she called bad habits. And my therapist laughed and said, yeah, they're not all that bad. You know, she started to become more stressful about the changes in me since the crash.
Yeah.
And ultimately I had to say, you know, the person before died in the crash, this is what you have left. And there's no going back. There's only building anew. And that's it. And honestly, to put a really sharp point on it, our marriage vows say till death do us part. What happens when one of us dies? No matter that we return. Our covenant is broken. The only reason we stay together now is simply because we choose to.
Well, and that is a huge, huge message because that's one of those after effects. And it really is true. All of a sudden, the desires, the values, the goals, the things that you find joyful in life aren't the same as what you built a relationship on. When you're having a camaraderie, you're laughing at the same jokes, you're looking at the same events as saying, I want to go here. And the other person saying, not really, not really. And so that's a huge challenge that people have, not only with your spouse, but with your relationships with friends, with coworkers, with people who knew you before. And these are parts and parcel of the things that have to be unpacked when an experiencer comes back and says, where do I go from here? Because what you have now, you value in some ways even more, but you don't want to lose or diminish the people who got you to where you are because they still, in some way, shape, or form, had a part of putting the bricks in place that you walked on to get to this point. But how do you let them know that I still love you, I still care, I just need to do different things for us to be together? And that's where it falls. Whether you can go beyond that or not. And I'm glad that you're also including that in your story because I think that's a crucial part that sometimes gets overlooked as to what happens with relationships after these kinds of experiences because they do shift.
You know, you're so right there. And, you know, it's one thing if we just talk about near-death experiences in terms of, again, how beautiful they can be as experiences and then all the wonderful, say, psychic abilities or, you know, things that we come back or to humorously talk about the after effects, like, hey, we blow light bulbs up all the time, things like that. But I think there is a cost and there is a price to this experience. And, you know, certainly some of it is wrapped up in are redefining ourselves based upon the different people we realize we are now. And some of it definitely will come at the cost of relationships that we were comfortable with. But, you know, it's like, even though we could say we didn't consciously choose to have this new path in front of us,
right,
we can certainly say that those who didn't experience didn't choose it. So if they can't pull on, it really doesn't come down to, you know, good and bad people. It just comes down to overwhelmed people. And it's totally understandable if within a marriage or a formally committed relationship, one decides they just cannot walk that path at this time. And that's okay. That's okay. You have to let them go and love them. And you have to be true to yourself, just as they have to be true to themselves.
And some of this has to do with each person. And you got to see yours. Not everybody gets to go see the in-between and all the nuts and bolts of what's happening and what might happen and all the possibilities. Obviously, this was something that in terms of you going forward is a crucial part of your journey. So the person who's with you now is going, I don't really want to know the end. I don't want to know the nuts and bolts. I don't want to know the in-between. I want to know how we get to the park on Sunday with all of our friends and bringing the cake and who's going to, you know, all that. All of a sudden, they're right here in the manifest plane where all of this is super, super hyper real. And you're in the expanded plane where all of this down here is a bunch of ants.
Well, that's kind of how it is. And you know, you can't go back, and they know they don't know how to go forward. So sometimes you can come to an impasse in terms of your traveling time together. And honestly, as you start to realize how you've been removed from the crowd, you know, obviously we're still human as well. And we can be solitary. We can be by ourselves, but obviously where we might look for some validation, we'll start to redefine our relationships. And a natural place is to start to do research online and discover things like the International Association of Near-Death Studies or the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. Read other people's accounts. You'll probably find, maybe if you're lucky, one or two that are similar to yours. You might even be able to reach out to those people and start to form relationships. You can go to local meetings or conferences and find other people. And in my first international conference for IAMS, it was really interesting to walk around and see all these strangers looking at each other, and yet there was a hint of recognition in their eyes. And then all of a sudden, people are sitting down on couches or in the corners of restaurants sharing very intimate details about their lives. And I think, like you were alluding to before, what happens next? That's the first question you ask in the integration process, which follows. And I think some people said it goes 7 to 10 years of your life. I think it goes on to your last breath. And that's what all of these discussions were about, you know, talking about how easily, not that often, or how much challenge there is to integrate it into their everyday lives and how they've worked to do that. Like you were saying, changing jobs. Sometimes you have to change your relationships. Things that you want to authentically make more reflective of who you are as a changed person.
Yeah. Yeah. My job describe the things I'm looking for now have no relationship to what I looked for, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It's just completely different. And my expectations of myself, of all of that, are different. And so it doesn't mean you let yourself off the hook. It just means that there are certain things that you find more important to focus on, and it might not meet what society's expectations or their definition of success. All of a sudden, those things are completely off the table. And with this, you know, when I'm looking at you saying your next book is going to be The Practice of the In-Between, I think that's what you said. Was it The Practice of the In-Between?
The Practice in Between. Yeah. The Art of Letting Go.
These things change people. And I think more of us are being able to be exposed and learn that it's actually, in some way, shape, or form, improving the relationships, because they're more authentic. There's less degree of trying to hide behind a facade.
Here's what it is, because like you say, as you become more real in your relationship, you'll also become more authentic in a way that says, okay, before I might have been the kind of person who had been attracted to someone who I thought was, you know, beautiful, and I wanted to possess that. Or they may have been very successful in the world, and I wanted to have more of that in my life, and things like this. But when the day comes that you essentially, you don't want to be lonely, but you're also not pursuing relationships because of a transactional attitude, you know, what can you do for me?
Right.
Then you're much more open in how you come together. And to me, best I understand it, that is the solution to codependency.
Yes. Yes. Because you want the person for what they bring to the equation in themselves, that they are happy, they're content, they love what they're doing or who they are, not because of, well, I don't have that, so I want that, and I can walk beside it and look like I have it, even though I don't have to do anything about it. It's like, wait.
So what do you think that would do to our 53% divorce rate if people approach relationships like that?
Well, they would, yeah, that would be a tad different. They'd have different mentality, but you know, society all sets that up. Do you, you know, that's, this is a flip flop for society because those things are set out as goals. Find someone who's rich, find someone who's gorgeous, find someone who has a car, find someone who has a house, all instead of finding someone who's truthful, find someone who's kind.
Right. Well, that's a big part of the letting go portion of the book that's coming up, and that's, you know, we're always chasing after the one more thing. I need the one more car. I need the one more suit. I need the one more degree. I need the one more higher status job, whatever, to get to where I need to go. And you know what? We'll be chasing the one more thing with our last breath when we go. And the only people who will profit are the people who are selling the one more thing.
Yes.
But once we realize, you know what? When we hold a baby, we're holding someone. Usually, I'm saying we're holding someone right there who has all the secrets in the universe to being a happy spiritual being.
Yeah.
What the heck happens along the way? You know, puberty happens. Now we want to conform. We want to connect. We don't want to, you know, if we're a young woman in a math class, we may not want to, you know, show up the boy we're interested in by being smarter. So we keep quiet. And it's like, you just want to shake everybody and say, snap out of it. Come on. Everybody needs to be the best they can. And we need to cheerlead each other on. But when we're chasing these one more things, it's this attitude that we're never good enough, that we have to keep, you know, jumping through somebody's hoop in order to be good enough. But the day we can start to let go of that and say, no, I have everything I need right now, is a really good part of the attitude of letting go. We don't need one more thing to have a near-death experience. We don't need one more thing to have a spiritually transformative experience. And as the in-between told me, it's not a place you go to or come from. It's a place you are. So our goal should always be to keep at least one foot in that world.
Okay, last question. The paranormal element. Okay, the light bulbs thing. What about computers? Are you dangerous around electronics?
Yes.
I had a feeling.
Computers act wonky. I've blown up my entire HVAC system in my home, including four of the five damper motors in the ductwork with a power surge.
Uh-huh.
Blew up my mom's transformer outside her house with a power surge. And I asked, you know, how does that happen? She says, never. And then she tried to call her friend on her copper wire phone, the kind that never go down. And the phone suddenly went dead for 5 minutes and nobody could use it. And those never go down.
Mm-hmm.
Electronic communications, when I was 20 minutes outside of PMH's house on my first visit, an NDE friend of mine texted me through Facebook Messenger on my phone, which I was using for my GPS navigation. And she said, I don't know what I'm thinking of. You know, I said, because I'm 20 minutes away from PMH's house. And then while she's texting her next thing, and you can see the little dot, dot, dots indicating she's typing, my text field suddenly filled in on its own. Yeah, my hands are on the steering wheel. There is no radio on with dictation mode engaged. It's totally silent in my car other than the engine noise. And my text field filled in saying, thank you for being a kind and loving person.
I love that.
Someone said, I guess your spirit guides know how to use your phone.
Oh,
I told PMH this, and she said, oh, this is just the beginning. It really has. PMH and I have become very, very good friends. And she really is my mentor in many ways and my go-to on other things. And she's just a wonderful, you know, prolific NDE researcher.
Yes.
Can't say enough good about her.
Yes. Tons and tons of energy. And so fantastic that she does have that, because that's people need resources. They need hope. They need some kind of connection that says, this is not fiction. This is real. These things happen and they are natural, normal, but you do have to be aware that when you blow out somebody's transformer and their power is done and they have to have $1,000 reconnect bill, that there's an extent to some of the fallout from these experiences. But I think that's where we're going as as a species. I do think that these things are part of our evolution, and this is just a little like a warning note, a little thing of, okay, get ready, because 3.0 is going to be
cool.
I
want to support what you're saying. I want to support what you're saying with a huge statement. To me, this is the second coming. Yeah. That's what this is. It will be as much by having it come through us as individuals with our own individual connections and paths with God and each other. It's no less a paradigm buster as the first coming mm-hmm. in its own way.
Yeah.
And I think we should treat it that way, and we should look at it as positive as we can.
Oh, yes. Yes. Your experience, I think, was straight on in terms of not giving you too many things to connect to there and saying, okay, this is a desolate landscape. Now I've got your full attention, don't I? Wink, wink. I am the egg.
Exactly. Just enough ambiguity to stretch and feel stretched to the max. But now the dots are connecting. And it's like we've said before, you know, you don't have to be perfect to have a perfecting experience. You don't have to have already been somewhere to be pointed in the right direction of where to go. Now you just have to walk that path, and you know, if other people can walk with you for a little while, it's great.
Okay, so the next book is coming out when?
I'm working on it now. My target goal is to have it ready to go into editing at the end of August, and they'll need about 4 weeks. So I would say in the fourth quarter of this year, it should be out, as well as the audio and ebook version.
Okay. So to get up to speed, if you're listening now, The In-Between, A Trip of a Lifetime, Jim Bruton, and you'll find out where he has been and all the extraordinary life experiences he had before the card flipped over and he became 2.0. 2.0. Whoops, there. 2.0. 2.0 and water. And shake well. So one way or the other, though, this, I think, is a fantastic journey. I think 3 is on the way. It's just a matter of you getting this one. And then as the electrical components start to really ramp up, we're looking at a really exciting next generation, the 3.0. I have no idea where you're going from here. But what I do hope is that you will provide visuals and have a few more chats with that cigar and your source and say, how can I ramp this up? Because people are waiting for the rest of the story.
I'm planning on heading out right now after we're done.
Okay, watch for the electrical storms. You'll know where he is. Jim Bruton, thank you for talking with me, and safe travels, and keep the stories coming.
Thank you, Wendy. It's been great. Thank you for your time today, and thank you to all of your listeners who joined us.
And the website for Jim is inbetweenproductions.com. Check it out. Thanks for listening.